Well, thank you, Sharon. Appreciate that very much. Another very appropriate song for not just the time of year we're in, but for our spiritual life, our Christian life. Absolutely do want God's will to be done in our lives and everything that we do. So the message today that I'm going to give you, I gave it before. I'll just give you a heads up. It's called Vantage Point. So if you guys want to go ahead and sleep, you can. However, there will be a pretty heavy-duty spiritual, salvational, maybe that's a better word, test afterwards. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding about the test part. I did give this sermon before. I've changed a little bit of it. But the reason I want to give it again is because in a couple weeks, I'll be giving a part two to this. So I want to give this again to kind of refresh our memory of what this is. And then I hope you'll appreciate part two. Part two seems to be coming together quite nicely. So we'll see. But Vantage Point, we all know what Vantage Point is. And as I addressed it before, there was a movie in 2008 called Vantage Point. Does anybody remember that movie? Okay. Does anybody remember this sermon? Okay, a few people do. Okay. Well, that's all right. Then I won't look too bad on you guys if you sleep. But for those of you who did not see the movie, Vantage Point was a movie to the plot to kill the president. And it was seen from several different vantage points or points of view from different people. And they all had their take on what actually happened. And so I used that theme to do Vantage Point Crucifixion Week, to kind of get, and I'm using six different people's vantage point or different people's view on what happened in and up to and through the crucifixion of Jesus Christ. So without any further ado, we'll go ahead and start. My very first vantage point is Caiaphas the high priest. And I called his angle sin of envy. Sin of envy. So Caiaphas doesn't officially get started in this until Matthew chapter 26. So you might turn to Matthew chapter 26. That's where we'll start. Matthew chapter 26, and we'll start in verse 3. It says, then chief priests, the scribes, and the elders of the people assembled at the palace of the high priest, who was called Caiaphas, and plotted to take Jesus by trickery and kill him. You notice that? That's the whole plot. To take Jesus Christ by trickery, which means they were going to lie, they were going to try to do anything they could, and their ultimate goal was to kill him. Now, I guess that shouldn't surprise us. Caiaphas, on the other hand, he was not a fan of Jesus Christ anyway. And he hadn't been for quite some time. So now, if you'll go forward to Mark chapter 14, we'll pick up the story here. Mark chapter 14, verse 53. Mark 14, verse 53. Then they took Jesus to the high priest, and all the chief priests, now listen to how they explain all this. All the chief priests, the elders, and the teachers of the law came together. So anybody who was anybody in that time having to do with their teachings, they were there. That was a very intimidating group, to say the least. Verse 54, Peter followed him at a distance, right into the courtyard of the high priest. There he sat with the guards and warmed himself at the fire. The chief priests and the whole Sanhedrin, think about this, were looking for evidence against Jesus so that they could put him to death. That was their goal. But they did not find any. Many testified falsely against him, but their statements didn't agree. So they got together. They conjured up these lies, and they couldn't even agree on the lies. Now, you'd think if you was going to try to condemn somebody or do something to somebody, and you're going to plot against him, you'd at least get together with your fellow friends and get your story straight. They couldn't even do that. They couldn't get their story straight. Verse 57, Then some stood up and gave this false testimony against him. And this is what they said. We heard him say, I will destroy this temple made with human hands, and in 3 days we'll build another, not made with human hands. And even at this, it says, yet even then their testimonies did not agree. So they couldn't even get that part right. Verse 60. Then the high priest stood up before them and asked Jesus, are you not going to answer? What is this testimony that these men are bringing against you? He's saying, listen here. You know, this is for your life. They're saying all these things. Are you not going to answer? Verse 61. But Jesus remained silent and gave no answer. He remained calm. He held himself together. Could you or I do that? If somebody's lying about us, lying to our face, lying to us in front of a whole group of seemingly educated individuals, and knowing that this is life or death. Verse 61 says, he remained silent and gave no answer. He stayed calm. Look at verse 62. Or the last part of verse 61 here. Again, the high priest asked him, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? So you see, he asked him a pointed question here. Up to this point, they were just kind of a random, so be it type questions. And then he said, are you the Messiah, the Son of the Blessed One? And Jesus said, I am. I am, said Jesus. And you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the Mighty One and coming on the clouds of heaven. The high priest tore his clothes. Can you just imagine what he was thinking? He was probably so frustrated at this point, he couldn't stand it anymore. It says, the high priest tore his clothes. Why do we need any more witnesses, he said. You have heard this blasphemy. What do you think? They all condemned him as worthy of death. They all passed judgment on him. Verse 65. Then some began to spit on him. They blindfolded him, struck him with their fists, and they said, prophesy. And the guards took him and beat him. Now, there's a lot more to the story. We're not going to get into that right now. But what we see here is Jesus Christ. You all, we all know this is an innocent man. Being brought before the Sanhedrin, being brought before the high priest, Caiaphas. And this was immediately after he was arrested. The chief priests, the elders, the teachers of the law, they all have assembled together to look for any kind of evidence they could find, and they would manufacture if they had to. Witness after witness is brought to testify falsely. That's important. This is all illegal. Falsely against him. But they contradicted each other. They never did offer any proof against him. But they contradicted each other. In the center of all this, think about this, you know, maybe a group as large as this, or maybe a little larger, of Sanhedrins, of these law people, and Jesus Christ right in the center. Think about that. He stands there, silent, unmoving, and he's calm. As it becomes very, very clear that no two of all this group, no two witnesses can agree. They can't get their story straight. Caiaphas grows increasingly agitated at this whole thing, and he finally calls a halt to everything. And that's when he asks Christ, you're not going to answer for what these witnesses bring against you? Well, none of them could agree, so there was really no need for an answer. Complete silence. And impatiently, as we just read, Caiaphas asked his question. Are you the Christ? Are you the Son of the Blessed? And then in verse 62, that's when Jesus says, I am. I can imagine what that crowd said at that point, or what they did. And then Jesus went on to claim to be the Messiah, the Son of God, and if that weren't enough, he goes on to associate himself with God sitting in judgment. Now, we know that to be true. They didn't, and they certainly didn't want to hear that. So this gave them the fire, the ammunition that they needed, the fuel that they needed. Now, Sanhedrins, they knew the Bible, and they knew that Jesus here, when he was talking here, he was making reference back to Daniel, Daniel chapter 7. Let's go back to Daniel chapter 7. Daniel chapter 7. We'll look in verses 13 and 14. Daniel 7, verse 13. I saw in the night vision, and behold, one like the Son of Man come before him. Verse 14. Then to him was given dominion and glory and a kingdom that all people, all nations and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion, which shall never pass away, and his kingdom, the one which shall not be destroyed. They knew exactly what Christ was referring to. They realized that Jesus Christ is saying that those who are judging him will see him in the future on the seat of judgment with God in the last days. They understood this. Caiaphas recognized his cue here, and playing to all the group that was there, he tears his clothes in horror. You can just about imagine this. You know, Christ said this, and he just, oh, I can't believe this. He tore his clothes and maybe fell to the ground. I don't know, it doesn't say that. But he's making a big showing here. Then they say, blasphemy. Blasphemy. Condemn him. Put him to death. And at that point, they're spitting on him. They're blindfolding him. They're hitting him. They're taunting him. And they take him away to beat him. Taking their cue from Caiaphas, I guess I'm right, they remove Jesus from the area. And we know how the story goes. He is all but tortured to the point of death. What was their purpose in going after Jesus? What was their purpose in this? Well, Pilate gives us a clue here in Mark chapter 15. Mark chapter 15, verse 10. Mark 15, verse 10 says, for he knew that the chief priest had handed him over because of envy. There it is. What was going on? Well, Caiaphas and the leaders, if you recall, Jesus had driven out the money changers just a short time before this, and was putting a damper, if you will, on the leaders' financial schemes. Yeah, they had some schemes going on here. They had it going on. Look, go back to Mark chapter 11 here. Mark chapter 11, verses 15 through 18. So they came to Jerusalem. Then Jesus went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple, and overturned the tables of money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. Then he taught, saying to them, Is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations? This is what he's saying. Do you not get this? But you have made it into a den of thieves. So he just called them out on it. Verse 18. And the scribes and chief priests heard it. Now think about that. They heard what he was saying here. They heard his teaching. They heard him calling them out. And what did they do? They didn't say, oh, I'm sorry. Oh, forgive us. So the scribes and the chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him. For they feared him, because all the people were astonished at his teaching. Brethren, it's amazing what the truth will do. You know, we know the truth said, you know, we're told in the Bible, the truth will set you free. The truth gives you that pass, or that peace that surpasses all understanding? That's what the truth does for you, for me, for us. They were scared to death that the people were going to be an uprising against them and follow this Jesus Christ guy. So Jesus Christ here cleansed the temple. He drove out the money changers, overturned the benches of those who were selling pigeons and doves. The chief priest, they had a religious racket going on here. They were making pretty good money selling the sacrificial animals to the people for Passover. It was coming up. They were on the edge of it. Only the rich could afford to buy these sacrificial animals at the very, very high prices that these priests and their cohorts had set. So the chief priest was using the house of God to rip people off. And Jesus Christ condemned them for it. He saw it. He saw what he called them out. He said, "This is what you're doing. Don't you know better than this?" Jesus Christ stands on principle. I hope that you and I stand on principle. These are the lessons that we can learn from each one of these vantage points. The people liked to listen to Jesus, as the most part. You don't have to turn there, but Mark, write this down if you will. Mark 12, verse 37 says the common people heard him gladly. That means they wanted to hear him. They appreciated what he had to say. Now, not all of them, but the common people, it says, heard him gladly. You know, Jesus clearly had the people on his side, if you will. All during that week, he was drawing very, very large crowds. They wanted to hear this truth. And the chief priests, who normally had these crowds, they were kind of reduced to being spectators themselves instead of having crowds follow them around. So you could see where it started getting under their skin. So they didn't like it. Okay, keep that vantage point in mind. Let's go to our next one. This is Judas. Judas, the sin of betrayal. Now, betrayal is defined as this: a violation of a person's trust or confidence of a moral standard. Let me repeat that. Betrayal is a violation of a person's trust or confidence of a moral standard. Judas's position in crucifixion week is that of a betrayer. An interesting fact in Mark 3, verse 19, is where we read the list of disciples. It calls out in verse 19, Judas Iscariot, who also betrayed him. So the first thing that we read about Judas is that he's a betrayer. He betrayed Christ. That's the first thing we read about him. Jesus was betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. There are a couple of possibilities of this value. I don't know if you remember this or not, but the one is, if it's a shekel, it's 30 pieces of silver. If it's a shekel, then they would be worth about 120 days' wage. And if they were a denarius, then they would be equal to about 30 days' wage for a soldier at that time, or a working individual, maybe a fisherman or that kind of thing. So if you can translate that into today's wages, and I just went with the average fisherman because that was the predominant mode of work back then. A fisherman, so between these two, that would be somewhere between $6,450 and $25,800. So, you know, whatever it was, it seems that Jesus Christ was worth less than Judas, than 30 pieces of silver. So if it was $6,400 or if it was $25,000, still, Judas is saying Christ's life is worth less than that. Let's go to Matthew chapter 26. Matthew chapter 26, we'll start in verse 21. As they did eat, he said, "Verily I say unto you, that one of you shall betray me." And they were exceedingly sorrowful, and began, every one of them, to say unto the Lord, Is it I? I want you to think about this as we read this. Think about this as from a personal standpoint. Put yourself here. Verse 22. And they were exceedingly sorrowful, I said that, and they asked, Is it I? And he answered, and he said, He that dips his hand with me in the dish, the same shall betray me. The Son of Man goes as is written of him. But woe unto that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. It had been good for that man if he had not been born. Verse 25. Then Judas, which betrayed him, answered and said, Master, is it I? He said unto him, You have said it. You notice here how only Jesus at this point knew that Judas was the one who would betray him. None of the other disciples, the other 11, say they're suspected of a thing. Have we ever considered that point before? The idea that we never know if there's a Judas in our midst. Is it us? You know, we're really quick and it's very easy to blame somebody else. But by our actions, by our attitudes, is it us? Every one of them asked that question. That gives you something to think about. Every one of these apostles, these disciples of Jesus Christ, asked Jesus Christ, Is it me? This goes back to how much we should be, how important it is for each one of us to do self-examination, not just this time of year, but especially this time of year, but all year long. Do we ever want to be a Judas? No. The idea that we never know is kind of a scary thing. The disciples here were taken by surprise at this. They didn't know who Christ was talking about. They didn't know about the theft and the arrangement with the authorities that has already been made, already taken place. They didn't know about that. He had been with them. Judas had been with them. And obviously he had been with them a lot, masquerading, but they did not know him. He deceived them. He pretended to be a disciple, just like they were, when he was actually a deceiver. He was a betrayer. That's pretty hard. It's very heavy when we think about that. Let's jump down here to verse 47. We'll continue on. Verse 47 of Matthew 26. And while he was still speaking, we haven't left yet, we're still at the table, or at this meeting, if you will. And while he was still speaking, behold, Judas, actually, I'm sorry, we did. We have now moved to the garden. I missed a few verses there. And while he was still speaking, Judas, one of the 12, with a great multitude, with swords and clubs, came from the chief priests and the elders of the people. Now his betrayer had given them a sign, saying, Whomever I kiss, he is the one. Seize him. And immediately he went up to Jesus and said, Greetings, Rabbi. And he kissed him. But Jesus said to him, Friend, notice that. He said, Friend, why have you come? Then they came and laid hands on Jesus, and they took him. Again, we just left the house, the room where they met. All this transpired. Judas left. He went about his business. He went to take care of this betrayal, to get it going. And Christ took the rest of the disciples to the Garden of Gethsemane, Mount of Olives. They were there. And Judas shows back up. Jesus Christ knew exactly what was happening here. He knew what was going on. But you notice in verse 50, he asked him, he said, Friend. He addressed him as friend. Why have you come? Yeah, he knew why he came, but it was a test. But what we see here, and what Christ was pointing out, one of the things he was pointing out, that Jesus knew Judas was a false friend. A false friend. And he still offered Judas his friendship. You know, Christ knew what he was, but he didn't say, "Be gone. I condemn you." He knew what he was. He calls him friend. Jesus did not disown Judas, even after what he had done. So that's what I go back to this question. How much are we like Judas? That's something we need to ask ourselves. I hope the answer is none. But I go back to every one of the disciples said, "Is it me?" Brother, that leaves room for us to consider things. Consider this. Judas is called one of the 12. One of the 12. He was a part of what you might call the inner circle of Jesus Christ. And that is enough. I think that is enough for each one of us to ask, as Judas did, "Lord, is it I? Do I have the tendency to betray Christ? Each one of you, myself. Do I have that tendency to do that?" What about us? What about our value? Where do we, as people, fit in? We may not be ready to betray our best friend for 30 pieces of silver, and I hope we're not, but what might we be willing to sacrifice if the price is right? Are we a friend of someone only because of what that person could give for us, can do for us? And if so, yeah, we've earned the title false friend. If we're a friend of somebody only for what they can do for us, we better rethink that friendship. And it's on our part, it's not theirs. So what happened to Judas? Matthew 27, verse 3 through 5. Then Judas, his betrayer, it always puts that in there because it does not want any of us to ever forget that. I say it, God does not want us to forget this. Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, "I have sinned by betraying innocent blood." And they said, "What is that to us? What is that to us? You see to it." And he threw down 30 pieces of silver in the temple and departed, and he went and hanged himself. Have you and I ever done something? And I'm not asking for a show of hands by any means. But have you and I ever done something that we felt so bad about that we went back and we tried to fix it? And that person or individual or individuals said, "It's not my problem, it's yours." Doesn't that leave an awful guilt over us? It did here. He threw down a 30 piece of silver in the temple. He departed and he went and hanged himself. What Judas said here was true. He did sin and betray Jesus Christ. Jesus, who was innocent, was just about at this point to pay with his own blood, the sacrifice to cover Judas's sin. How amazing. How amazing is that? Let's go to our next vantage point. Peter. This is sin of denial followed by forgiveness. Sin of denial followed by forgiveness. You know, Peter's vantage point is one of a denier as well. It was Passover, 31 AD. It was a very personal experience for Simon Peter. On that night, Jesus had eaten with his disciples. We're talking about that a little bit. Then they sang a hymn, and then he went to the Mount of Olives. The following four sets of verses tell what happened next, and each one of them add a little bit more information. Let me just tell you what they are, then I'm going to go through them. It's Matthew 26, 31 through 35, and I'll go through these again so you can write them down. Mark 14, 27 through 31, Luke 22, 31 through 34, and then John 13, 33 through 38. You know, they would most likely read in sequence. Jesus kind of tells his disciples that he's going to go where they cannot come. He told them that. He's going to the cross. You and I know the whole story. Of course, Peter asked, he said, Lord, where are you going? You know, he wanted to know. Peter was, you know, pretty close to him. Jesus says, you know, you can't follow me, but you will later. Now, if you remember, later on, the history says that Peter was crucified upside down because he said he didn't feel worthy enough to be crucified in the manner of Jesus Christ. Peter asked, he said, Lord, why can't I follow you now? He said, I will die for you. And Christ said, if you remember the famous quote, we'll read it here in a minute, he says, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you, that he might sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith fail not. And when you are converted, strengthen the brethren. So we'll get into more of this in just a minute. But Christ, he put things in perspective. Peter didn't understand at the time, and probably the rest of the disciples didn't either. But you and I see it now, and we can put the whole story together, and we do understand. So let's go ahead and go to Matthew chapter 26, if you will. Verse 31. Matthew 26, verse 31. Then Jesus said to them, all of you will be made to stumble because of me this night, for it is written, I will strike the shepherd, and the sheep of the flock will be scattered. Now, think about this as we read this. He goes, but after I have been raised, now this is not the first time the disciples have heard this story about being raised, about what's going to happen, and about being raised, but they didn't get it. And even at this point, they still don't get it. So, but after, in verse 32, but after I have been raised, I will go before you to Galilee. Peter answered and said to him, even if all are made to stumble because of you, I will never be made to stumble. Now, we read this. Isn't this exactly when we go back and say, never say never? Peter said never. He said, I will never be made to stumble. Peter was just a few hours away from stumbling huge. Verse 34. Jesus said to him, assuredly I say to you, that this night, before the rooster crows, talking directly to Peter, you will deny me three times. Do we think Peter got it at that point? I don't think so. He thought, yeah, well, you know, this is just another one of your parables, your stories you're telling, and it doesn't make sense. I don't know what you're saying, but I'll go with you on this. I mean, I don't know if that's what he said or not, but his actions kind of led you to believe that he didn't get it. Okay, let's go to Mark. Mark chapter 14. We see a more emphatic response here. In Mark 14, I'm going to read verse 31, then we'll go back down to verse 66. Verse 41, though, he says this. But he spoke more vehemently, and he said, now you can imagine Peter saying this, if I have to die with you, I will not deny you. So if we just left it at that, we say, well, yeah, okay, Peter's a little feisty here. You know, he really means what he says. But it wasn't just Peter. And they all said likewise. So, you know, we always talk about Peter denying Christ, because that's the example we always read. But here, Mark says that they all said they wouldn't deny Christ. All of them. Where were they? In just a few hours, they scatter. They scatter like flies. They're gone. Where were they? Well, we don't know. They didn't hang around. And Peter had great confidence in himself here. But as we know, he failed and he denied Christ three times. Exactly what Christ said. We as Christians tend to identify with Peter, especially in his weakness rather than his strength. We identify with him in the trial scene when he denies Christ. We know that that could have been us if the circumstances were different. You and I proclaim to be a Christian. You and I hope, we stand up from a mountaintop and proclaim Jesus Christ and God the Father, and we are Christians. Let somebody put a gun at your head, and then what are you going to do? Let's drop down to verse 66, Mark 14. Now, as Peter was below in the courtyard, we read a little bit of this earlier, one of the servant girls of the high priest came. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she looked at him and said, "You also were with Jesus of Nazareth." But he denied it, saying, "I neither know nor understand what you are saying." And he went out on a porch, and a rooster crowed. I don't know if he caught that. He might not have. He might have been in so much denial that he didn't catch that, at least at this point. I don't know. Verse 69. And a servant girl saw him again and began to say to those who stood by. So now she's getting some people riled up. She goes, "This is one of them." She's talking to Peter. "This is one of them." But he denied it again. And a little later, those who stood by Peter, said to Peter again, "Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean, and your speech shows it." You know, there's just some things you can't get away from. I told this in Paintsville a couple weeks ago. I gave a sermon. Debbie and I went to Canada first part of last year, and we stopped at Walmart. You know, Walmart, you know, that's a universal store. Everybody knows Walmart. And the lady looked at me, and she says, I said, "Hi." She looked at me, and she says, "You must be from the Deep South." Well, I'm a Galilean, I guess. I said, yeah, I'm from Ohio. That's the Deep South. Well, for them it would be. But she was able to identify me by my speech. Well, they did here with Peter too. They said, "Surely you are one of them, for you are a Galilean, and your speech shows it." So you can't deny it. And then verse 71. Then he began to curse and swear. So Peter was wound up. He didn't just say, "No, you're mistaken, excuse me." He cursed. And he swore. He said, "I do not know this man of whom you speak." That doesn't get any more of a bold denial than that right there. What happened? Peter had good intentions. We saw that early on. Even determination, if you will, to follow Jesus Christ. I can say that for anyone in here. He would do what Christ told him to do. But it wasn't too awful long. He was cursing and denying the very Jesus Christ that he was following. Why? Well, okay, let's throw some human reasoning with this. Maybe he was overwhelmed by standing in Caiaphas' house. Okay, maybe. Maybe he was very scared of being arrested and treated the same way. Probably. Maybe he was intimidated about being in the middle of about 70 very well-educated religious men who were all, every one of them, against Jesus Christ. Possibly. Maybe he was disillusioned about Jesus and how Jesus appeared. Remember, he was beaten pretty bad at this point. Possibly. The fact is, we don't know. We don't know for sure. The Bible doesn't tell us why, but all that really matters is that Peter refused to identify with Jesus Christ. The man who had proven himself to Peter and the rest of the disciples, he denied him. And the bottom line, brethren, is this. There is absolutely never a justifiable reason for anyone who claims to be a Christian, who claims to keep the Sabbath, who claims to be a follower of God the Father and Jesus Christ, to refuse to identify with God the Father and Jesus Christ. Never. It doesn't matter how hard it gets. It doesn't matter how tough a situation we find ourselves in. There is never a right to do that. Let's continue on here. Mark 14, verse 72. A second time the rooster crowed. Then Peter called to mind the words that Jesus had said to him, "Before the rooster crows twice, you will deny me three times." And when he thought about it, he wept. You notice I read Matthew earlier. Matthew's just, it just only reports when the rooster crows. But then Mark puts a little more detail into it. And that seems more like what Christ would have said. When a rooster crows twice, you're going to deny me three times. That's how specific Christ was about what was going to happen. The rooster crowed. Peter had three times now denied Jesus Christ, just as Jesus Christ said he would. And again, we see Jesus was right about Peter, and Peter was wrong about what he thought he could do. He broke down and he wept bitterly. Think about that. How helpless he must have felt at that point. How helpless he was at that point. However, there's an extra dimension here. We read in Luke that the rooster crowed and Jesus turned and looked at Peter. To me, that's the ultimate right there. Go to Luke chapter 22. It's one thing for somebody to call you out on something, but whenever they look at you, your eyes meet their eyes and you know you're guilty. He looked at Peter's eyes in that very moment of his greatest suffering. Luke 22, verse 61. And this here, Luke's account says it just a little bit different. It says in verse 61, "And the Lord turned and looked at Peter. Then Peter remembered the words of the Lord, how he said to him, 'Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times.'" Immediately, when Christ looked at him, all the memories came back. Can you imagine that experience? Can you imagine what Peter felt at that point? Peter's response was he wept bitterly. What else could you do? You know, you could pray, you could ask for forgiveness, but the human side of you is going to break down. And that's what Peter did. Peter's experience of Passover in 31 AD was not a pleasant meal and traditional family experience that you and I are going to be able to enjoy here in about 3 weeks. But instead, it was a revelation of Peter's deep failure, and also the need to be cleansed and forgiven by Jesus Christ and God the Father. Kind of makes it real, doesn't it? When you start thinking about the details here. But there is a happy ending to this here. Peter is restored, which does give hope. Gives hope to every one of us sitting here. Peter tells each and every one of us that he was an eyewitness to Jesus' suffering. You can turn there. It's 1 Peter 5, verse 1. I'll just read it to you. It says, "The elders which are among you, I exhort," this is Peter saying, "who am also an elder and a witness of the suffering of Christ, and also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed." So he's just letting us know that he was there. There is hope and forgiveness, though, in this story. When Jesus arose from the dead, 3 days later, he said to the women, this is Mark 16, verse 7. Mark 16, verse 7. It says, but go tell his disciples and Peter that he is going before you into Galilee. There you will see him as he said you would," as he had been telling you all along. You know, Jesus specifically asked for Peter when he spoke to the women here. He appeared to him, but we never really know what transpired. One of these days, I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to ask him, or Peter, you know, what was that conversation about? What was it like? You know, because we have the history leading up to that. We know what Peter went through. We can just imagine, though, that Jesus probably looked into Peter's eyes again, and it was unconditional love and unconditional forgiveness, because that's who Christ is. Remember, Peter was strengthened after this, strengthened enough to later on become the one who stood up on Pentecost. And he spoke to the thousands of people. And he proclaimed the kingdom of God and Jesus Christ. Change the time and the place. This story could have been you and me. Maybe we haven't directly said, I don't know this Jesus. I hope we have never said that. But we have said it in our silence when we should have stood up for Christ, for the right thing, and we didn't. And again, we've all been there. We've all made mistakes. And I hope that's behind us. We'll all make mistakes in the future, I know. But we don't have to make these kind of mistakes. Passover is in part about our obedience and our need for personal salvation. When we repent of our sins and totally repent, which means change, we do not want to keep questioning. And remember this, do not keep questioning whether we have been forgiven. We must believe, brethren, that God does forgive when we ask. Peter's story is a great example of this. And there's much more we go into, but I'm going to move on. Number four, Pontius Pilate. This is a sin of weakness. From Pilate's vantage point during crucifixion week, he has a problem here. It's a problem, and there's not really an easy solution to it. So what we have here is after he denies Christ, and Christ was arrested, Pilate was brought into this by virtue of his job as governor. So here's the problem number one. The Jews wanted Jesus Christ dead. They wanted him dead, and only Pilate could pronounce the death penalty. And you can read that in Matthew chapter 27, verse 1 and 2. Problem number two is his wife had a dream. And she told Pilate, don't get involved with this Jesus guy. Don't do it. Stay away. Let's go to Matthew 27 and look at verse 19. So while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent to him, saying, have nothing to do with that Jesus, that just man. She calls him a just man. For I have suffered many things today in a dream because of him. So what was Pilate supposed to do here? You know, if he didn't please the Jews, there most likely would have been a riot. They would have reported him to the Roman officials, and he would have probably lost his job, maybe his life. That's how serious this was. But on the other hand, if he didn't please his wife, she was his wife. But there's much deeper. She was also the emperor's relative. And if she didn't think what he was doing was right, she could have reported him, and the outcome could have been the same. He could have, at minimum, lost his job, maybe even his life. So Pilate here had a dilemma. He had something to think about. At this point, we see weakness coming out in Pilate. There's a contrast here between him and Jesus Christ. Pilate is thinking about whether he should please his wife or please the Jews. That's his biggest concern. Jesus Christ, however, his only thoughts to this whole thing is on others. He is strength, if we will, to Pilate's weakness. Even during his trial, again, as I mentioned, it was illegal, his concern was for Pilate and the others. Go to John chapter 18. I think this is interesting. John chapter 18, verse 33 and 34. Christ kind of gave Pilate an out here, if you think about it. Of course, Pilate didn't take it. I don't think he saw it. John 18, verse 33. Then Pilate entered the praetorium again, called Jesus, and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus, verse 34, answered him, and this is the out. He said, "Are you speaking for yourself about this, or did others tell you this concerning me?" In other words, do you really want to know, or is somebody putting you up to this? You know, he probably could have got out of that and said, "Yeah, you're right, forget this." You know, that wasn't the way it was supposed to happen, and it didn't happen that way. Jesus knows that Pilate is getting caught up here by others, so he's being persuaded as well. So let's continue on to verse 35. Pilate answered, "Am I a Jew? Your own nation and the chief priests have delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, my servants would fight so that I should not be delivered to the Jews. But now my kingdom is not from here." Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say rightly that I am a king. For this cause I was born, and for this cause I have come into the world, that I should bear witness to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And when he had said this, he went out again to the Jews, and he said to them, "I find no fault in him at all." That's amazing. "I find no fault in him at all." Pilate was trying to avoid dealing with Jesus, and he, as his wife advised him, but now he couldn't control the events of the time. Things were too far in. Caiaphas was too clever. The people here were able to be manipulated. Jesus was not cooperating with their questioning, and Pilate lost control of the whole situation. So let's go to look for some little more detail in Luke chapter 23. Luke chapter 23, starting in verse 1. Then the whole multitude of them arose and led him to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We found this fellow perverting the nations and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar, saying that he himself is Christ, a king." So they're throwing this out there, trying to get a rise out of Pilate here, trying to, "Hey, look, you know, he's trying to take away from you. What is yours?" Then Pilate, verse 3, asked him, saying, "Are you a king of the Jews?" He answered him and said, "It is as you say." So Pilate said to the chief priest and the crowd, "I find no fault in this man." But they were more fierce, saying, "He stirs up the people, teaching throughout all Judea, beginning from Galilee to this place." Pilate really didn't care if someone declared themselves to be king of the Jews, as long as they did not affect Roman rule. As long as they did not try to take over the Roman Empire. That was what he cared about. This is the first time that Pilate declared Jesus to be innocent in the story flow. And he does it two more times before actually condemning him to the cross. Chapter 23, verse 6. This is what Pilate was looking for. When Pilate heard of Galilee, he asked if this man were a Galilean. And as soon as he knew that he belonged to Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. Now when Herod saw Jesus, he was exceedingly glad, not because he wanted to repent or wanted to worship Jesus. He was exceedingly glad, for he had desire for a long time to see him, because he had heard of the many things about him. And he hoped to see some miracles done by Christ. He wanted to see him do tricks. Verse 9. Then he questioned him with many words, but he, Christ, answered him nothing. And the chief priests and scribes stood and vehemently accused him. Then Herod, with his men of war, treated him with contempt and mocked him, arrayed him in a gorgeous robe, and sent him back to Pilate. That very day, Pilate and Herod became friends with each other, for previously they had been at enmity with each other. So you know, brethren, here it's just like things are today, in today's world. When someone doesn't want the responsibility of something, they shift it to someone else. I don't want to deal with it, let them deal with it. Pilate hears the word Galilee, and so he is very quickly ready to shift responsibility to Herod. And he didn't like Herod anyway, so he didn't really care. At this point, Herod really wants to see Jesus. He'd heard about him. He heard about this man doing miracles all along, you know, for the last 3+ years. And now he wanted to see Jesus do something. John the Baptist had previously talked to Herod, who had a hard heart, mind you. And Jesus had nothing to say at all. You notice when we read through that in Luke, he didn't answer him. Didn't say a word. Didn't say a word. So next, we see the chief priests and the scribes. It says they vehemently accused him, which means they probably were shouting angrily, probably screaming and yelling. You can imagine what that might have been. An interesting thing here, again, is told in Luke that Pilate and Herod became friends that day. They were uneasy rivals, part Jewish. Herod ruled over Galilee, Perea, with Roman Pilate ruled over Judea and Samaria. And he'd done this in place of Herod's half-brother, Archelaus. And he was removed by Rome. So there is probably where the bitter rivalry started. So their rivalry faded when they couldn't figure out what to do with Jesus. It's always a bit interesting how being against the truth, against the gospel, if you will, can bring rivals together. We see this all the time in the world. Well, let's continue on this. In verse 13 through 25. Then Pilate, when he had called together the chief priests, the rulers, and the people, said to them, "You have brought this man to me as one who misleads the people. And indeed, having examined him in your presence, I have found no fault in this man concerning the things which you accuse him." No, neither did Herod. So there's two, no fault. "For I sent you back to him, and indeed nothing deserving of death has been done by him. I will therefore chastise him and release him, for it was necessary for him to release one of them at the feast." And they all cried out at once, saying, "Away with this man, and release to us Barabbas, who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder." Pilate, therefore, wishing to release Jesus, again called out to them, but they shouted, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Then he said to them the third time, "Why? What evil has he done? I have found no reason for death in him. I will therefore chastise him and let him go." Now this is the third time he said this. He brought this up. But they were insistent, demanding with loud voices that he be crucified. And the voices of these men and the chief priests prevailed. So Pilate gave sentence that it should be as they requested. And he released to them the one they requested, who for rebellion and murder had been thrown into prison. But he delivered Jesus to their will. You know, Pilate was too weak to do the right thing. He didn't do the right thing. But we do know that he knew Jesus was innocent, which kind of makes it even worse. Pilate knew that if a riot started, he has a lot of trouble. History indicated that Pilate had been in trouble for this before in Rome, and if it happened again, he might, at the very least, lose his position as governor and he may even be killed. He understood that. Around this time, according to the Gospel of Matthew, Pilate washed his hands in front of the crowd before announcing, "I am innocent of this man's blood. See to it yourselves." You know, the Jewish people shouted in response, "His blood is on us and our children." They had no idea what they were saying. Pilate's obvious weakness here and lack of character play a major part in crucifixion week. This is a question, again, that we should be asking ourselves. Are we exceedingly weak spiritually? What about our character? Do we have godly character? Are we working on our godly character? Vantage point number 5. Barabbas, deserving of death. Barabbas. You know, we just read where Pilate made a show each year to release one of the prisoners as a goodwill gesture. This year he had two candidates, Jesus Christ and Barabbas. Let's compare the two. Jesus, of course, was a holy man. At different times, he was called the teacher. He was called the prophet. He was called the Messiah. None of these terms are dangerous. None of these terms are subversive, absolutely not violent. In fact, we know that Pilate concluded that Jesus was no threat to Rome. In the gospel, Barabbas is described in a different light. Let me just share a few of these with you. You can turn to them if you want. I'm going to go through them kind of quickly. There's four of them here. Matthew 27, verse 16. It says, "And at that time, they had a notorious prisoner called Barabbas." Notorious prisoner. That means he was well known for who he was and what he was. Mark 15, verse 7 says, "And there was one named Barabbas, who was chained with his fellow rebels, they had committed murder in the rebellion." So there's some kind of an uprising that they were part of, maybe even started it. Luke 23, verse 19 states, "Who had been thrown into prison for a certain rebellion made in the city and for murder." So we see this his resume just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And then John 18, verse 40 simply says, "Now Barabbas was a robber." You know, we see from the scripture that Barabbas was not what we would call the most upstanding citizen. He was not a guy you'd want for your neighbor. In fact, with this information, we can conclude that Barabbas was a rebel. He was in prison for committing murder during some type of possibly a political uprising. The difference between Christ and Barabbas are total opposites. Barabbas is committed to waging war against the Romans through use of direct violent actions. Jesus was a man of peace who approached, including turning the other cheek and going the extra mile. Complete difference here. When Roman soldiers were crucifying him, we all know what Jesus said. He asked God to forgive them. He believed in the very command of loving your enemies. When Pilate called for a decision, religious leaders stirred the crowd in favor of Barabbas. The crowd would get behind someone willing to fight for them, and turning the other cheek was not a popular thing to do. So they chose Barabbas. They wanted Barabbas released, while Jesus Christ, the innocent man, was led away to be crucified. It's what they wanted. So on one hand, his story is one of exchange. He has sinned, is due to die for his sins, and deserved to die for his sins. That sound like anybody here? Sound like all of us. However, without doing anything to deserve mercy, he discovered that Jesus Christ is going to die in his place. Now, he woke up Wednesday morning, expecting to die a slow, brutal death. But instead, he's released, and he's able to go home. He's able to celebrate whatever he celebrates, whatever he does with his family, while Jesus Christ is prepared for his death. If you stop and think, it's clear that this isn't only a story of exchange, it's a substitution. Both Jesus and Barabbas were accused of sedition. They were accused of insurrection, and they were both accused of treason. Barabbas was guilty, but the innocent Jesus Christ died in his place as his substitute, as his representative. Can we see ourselves in this? We are also deserving of death penalty, but we have found freedom in the very life through the death of Jesus Christ. How many times do we face a crisis or a trial and we have to choose between a Barabbas solution or a Jesus Christ solution? How many times do we choose the wrong option and we become deserving of death, just as Barabbas was? We need to think about these things. I'm not saying any of us is a Barabbas, but we still need to think about these things. Vantage point number 6. This is vantage point Mary, mother of Jesus, example of loving God. When considering Mary here, let's go to John chapter 19. John chapter 19, verse 25. Now there stood by the cross Jesus, his mother. Now there stood by the cross of Jesus, his mother, and his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. So we read that Mary was at the crucifixion. She was there. She was at the cross. Why would she come to Jerusalem to attend the execution of her adult son? Why did her other children let her do this? Well, here's the thing. She didn't come to Jerusalem for the crucifixion. She came to Jerusalem for the holy days, the spring holy days. You can turn to Luke 2 if you like. I'm going to read Luke 2, verse 41. Luke 2, verse 41 says this. Every year, Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the festival of Passover. This was nothing new to them. They did this every year. They did this all through the 33 years of Christ. They did this before Christ was born. They did this. This wasn't new. Mary and Joseph had a practice of attending the Passover celebration in Jerusalem. This is shown right here when Jesus was a baby. Years went by, and even after Joseph died, Mary kept going. It was a long, arduous trip over many miles, but she went continuously. So, in 31 AD, Mary didn't go to witness the crucifixion. She went to Jerusalem to keep the holy days. She also went because she loved God. She loved God as a child, and she was such a good example that God chose her to be the mother of Jesus Christ. We have no reason at all to believe anything had changed, because it's not written that anything changed. Her nature had not changed that we know of. Her devotion to God had certainly not stopped. However, once she was there this particular year, we know that she did end up at the cross. What would that be like? What would it be like to be there? To see her child battered and bruised, unrecognizable. It's hard to comprehend what she witnessed. None of us, but especially those with children, can imagine this scenario. But once there, something happened. In John 19, look at verse 26 and 27. John 19, verse 26. When Jesus therefore saw his mother and the disciple whom he loved standing by, he said to his mother, "Woman, behold your son." Then he said to the disciple, behold your mother. And from that hour, that disciple took her to his own home. So in this verse, we see that even though Jesus Christ, in his agony, he saw his mother, he spoke to her, and he loved her. That, there's no denying that. He made arrangements for her even at this point, in this point of the process. She was cared for. This suggests that possibly Jesus had been providing for her and now wants John to take that responsibility. We also should note that at this point he doesn't call her mother anymore. He calls her woman. Now, this is a term of respect. Nowadays, maybe not so much. It's almost a term of disrespect when someone looks at you and says, hey, woman, get over here. But that's not what it was then. That's how things change. At that time, it was a term of respect. But it also showed that the roles have changed now. He's no longer only her son, but now he's her savior. So what lesson do we learn from this part of the crucifixion story? Well, a major one is that there are a lot of hurting people who still love God. Even in the midst of great suffering, with unimaginable stresses and anguish for their children and their family, they still love God. And that's the way it should be. That love of God affects this vantage point. Mary loved God, and God loved Mary. So consider this. He could have kept Mary from going to Jerusalem that year, but maybe she was supposed to be in Jerusalem when Jesus was crucified. Not so much for the crucifixion, but for the resurrection. She went from experiencing great pain in her life at this time to absolutely tremendous joy. Probably more so than we could imagine or realize. We know that she continued this love for God, as we know that she joined the disciples and was part of the early church. So she did not in any way lose her faith. Let's look at one final section of scripture in Acts chapter 1. Acts chapter 1, verse 13 and 14. Acts 1, starting at verse 13. And when they had entered, they went up into the upper room where they were staying. Then it names them. Peter, James, John, and Andrew. Philip and Thomas. Bartholomew and Matthew. James, the son of Alphaeus. And Simon the Zealot. And Judas, the son of James. These all continued with one accord in prayer and supplication with the women and Mary, the mother of Jesus, and with his brothers. Mary's vantage point here was one of loving God, even through some of the greatest pain that any human can suffer and go through, until being delivered and seeing the joy that comes from these hard, hard circumstances. So, are we someone who loves God this much, even in the middle of this kind of pain? I hope we are. I hope we can be. Well, there's one final vantage point in this section to bring up, and this is called vantage point number 7, Jesus Christ. What is the relationship between all these individuals that we talked about today and Jesus Christ? Well, he died for all of them, and he died for all of us. That's part of the relationship. Vantage point Jesus Christ is the fact that he can see the good in all of mankind. He tells us which path to take, and he gives us complete instructions in which way we should go and how to go his way. Vantage point Jesus Christ is godly love poured out on all mankind. That's what vantage point Jesus Christ is. Friend, I hope that you all have a very, very inspirational next couple weeks leading up to Passover. And in just a few weeks, there's a part two of these vantage points that I think are very important for us to look at.